let's see. Right down here, Beth.
I have nothing wise to say. I just have to say that from the very beginning, when I heard this story as a child, I had the same trouble with so many Bible stories of listening to it as a woman. And if you think about it, of the choices of Bathsheba, you know, there isn't a whole lot. And you could talk about a lot of other stories from the Old Testament that way. And I can take a leap and look at it the way you're looking at it and say, oh, yes, there are wonderful things to learn here. But underneath, there's a burning of, you know, this is not right.
Well, of course that will be there. And thank you for raising that. That's, in a certain sense, a constant undertone in all these stories.
Yes.
In a rigidly patriarchal society, the woman was certainly property in a certain sense. Although there was honor granted, still, and I'm not able to really say much about that sociology, but the woman's take on these stories and the woman's point of view within them will be those that are heavily under an overlayer of masculine privilege, for sure. I think we can still gain some value out of them, even with and allowing that to be so.
But some of us have a hand tied behind our back.
That's important to realize, that there is that feeling and that fact. Well, it makes us ask again. Oh wait, there's one hand still up back there.
Two things.
Is that all?
Okay, two things. One was, in context of the female situation, I think it might be useful to recognize that in these stories, females are property, not people. And I think it's unkind to say, really, I think it's unkind to say that it's about male privilege. It is about ownership. And I think we should call it that. Because that is the experience that we have listening to it, as that we are chattel in these stories. So I just needed to say that. The other thing I wanted to say, though, was it seemed to me that there was a, in terms of David, there was some sort of a release in his getting it, his frustration, and his penitence that allowed the story to go forward.
Yes,
that I
indeed.
Think is related to the boundary you were talking about and the permission you were talking about.
I agree with you there. The one thing I would say about the position of the woman, and of course I'm saying it as a man, I realize that, is that male privilege also constitutes the privilege of ownership for ancient Hebrew culture.
I just wanted to follow these two women with some of my own feelings in the same vein. You started by asking the question, how did Solomon get wise? Maybe because his mother was Bathsheba.
I'm sure that Bathsheba had distilled a whole beaker of bitter wisdom out of her life experience. Okay, I think we need to move on just to keep up with our schedule. Another story that interests me, and you know, I'm giving just a kind of a snapshot of these stories. They're very complex and they have a context, and the context has to always be known and honored. So I don't want to pretend to give a complete exegesis, but I want to lift these up for you as examples of where we can take these twin principles of logos and mythos, put them together and see what we can make of it, and get more than a superficial story. Because after a while, the superficial story, we're done with it. We move on. But if we can see it in its internal organs, as it were, if we have X-ray vision, we can find life in it for a very long, through a lot of experience and time. Well, remember that Jesus came out of the desert after his baptism, and the text says that he was hungry. Well, he was headed to a party. It was the wedding party at Cana, And he got there. And you know this story. This is a very famous story in the Bible. He got to Cana, and Jesus, it seems to me from the context, was quite distracted there, quite distracted by what had occurred. The full range of what had been moving in him and presented itself to him, and I imagine made a fundamental change in his sense of calling, who he was, and what he needed to be doing. But it hadn't crystallized all that well yet, and I think if you had been at the party at Cana, you might have asked your partner, who is that interesting-looking young man over there who seems so to himself? Well, his mother was there, and some other members of his family, and it was a big party, I think, a lot of people, and they were eating and drinking and dancing. And, of course, the wine ran out. And Jesus' mother says to him, you know, they've run out of wine. And he said, don't really bother me with that. I don't think he even said please. Don't bother me with that, because it's not my time yet to be engaged in this new way. I'm still trying to digest what's going on with me. That's my addition. Well, Mary steps back, but she says to the steward who's overseeing the party, you do whatever he says. And then the word came again about the depleted wine. And Jesus, at that point, turns to the steward, and he points to 6 large stone jars. They were used in ritual consecrations, those jars. Each of them contained, according to what I was able to learn, maybe 15 to 20 gallons of liquid. And Jesus says, fill all of those jars to the top. Now, what's that? Do the math. That can be maybe 90 gallons of liquid. And he says, fill them to the top and then draw off from the bottom and take that to the principal steward. All of that was done. And it turned out to be very good wine that came out the bottom. It's really important in these texts to read them very closely. Every word. Because as the texts get passed from mouth to hand to mouth down through centuries, they get kind of burnished and rubbed off into smooth edges. And you lose some of the details of the text. At least so it seems to me. So what I like to do is read them so hard that I think I know what where every word is. The text here says only that Jesus gave an instruction to pour water in the top and take liquid off the bottom. That's all of any interaction he had. I find nothing in at least King James' account and in any place else I've read that said that Jesus performed any kind of act toward the water or the stone urns, that he commanded it, that he made a pronouncement, that he did anything that could be considered interacting with it. And yet when you read about this story in commentaries of all kinds, it'll be the story of the time when Jesus turned water into wine. Now, that's where I have a little bit of a beef, because I think the language is really, really telling and important. Maybe that goes overboard a little bit. But if I'm going to think that Jesus turned the water into wine, I'm going to reverse the tape a few days, go back in the desert, when he was invited to turn stones into bread. He said, no. People, humans, don't live by bread alone. Why could he not say, you know, you don't live by drinking wine? Why was the same value not applied in this case? Well, obviously, these are different situations. He was invited by his own power shadow, thanks to the friend who was so perceptive about that, invited by his own power shadow to do what looked like a benevolent act. If you can make bread from stones, voila, that's really marvelous. It's transformative for people. It's a social good. He said no to that. That would have been, I think, he was invited to take a direct, interactive gesture toward the stones, and with his power and his new status as the Son of God, to transform their very material reality. And he said, no, that's not what it's about. You've got the two realms mixed up. But over at Cana, he had no compunctions about being a party to, in some way, and it's not clear to me how he was a party to the what happened to the water from the top to the bottom. Does anybody have any thought about that? You want to? Let's see. Okay, there's a voice back there. The arm in the sky.
I started thinking about it practically. There's these sacramental jugs of that were, and they're very, very large, right?
Yeah.
Sacramental wine tends to be, at least in modern times, pretty dense, very, very dense. So maybe they were, they weren't supposed to be used for the wedding, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
I'm playing with it.
Yeah, you are. And you see what we're doing? We're sort of teetering on the dangerous step. We are a little bit, and I'm doing this too. We're taking a little bit the rationality of...
But I want to take that one step further and
okay,
say because it was a sacramental wine, maybe he wasn't supposed to do anything with those jugs. And he said, fill them up. And, you know, the wine that came out of the bottom was pretty good because it was a little bit watered down. Possible. Anyway,
yeah,
it was a thought.
I'm not sure, but I think the texts say that the jars were empty. Yes, very good.
Yeah, I've heard this story many times. People like to talk about drinking. But the thought that just occurred to me was that maybe the water really didn't turn to wine. People just thought it was wine. You know, it's a
placebo effect.
Thank you. You know.
Could be placebo, but that's very rational. It's a very objective explanation. I have a feeling that this story is pointing to something on the other side. And we haven't yet got close to it, but you see how easy it is to fall into a critique which brings these two realms together in an inappropriate way. And that's our first rule. Of private exegesis. Don't critique the passage with, if you say that it's not going to be a newspaper report, don't bring rational objective thought too close to it. And that's always a balance that has to be observed. Oh, somebody has a mic back there. And then we'll come to here in the middle.
So I just wanted to add my own two cents worth here into the discussion, and I'll go back a little bit, just briefly, to the discussion of David and Solomon and the story of Bathsheba by just reminding folks who may not have remembered this that Bathsheba is one of four women who are included in the genealogy of Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. All of these women are actually not Israelite. They are foreign women. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then also to add, getting back to John here, first of all, in the Gospel of John, there is no baptism of Jesus by John the Baptist, which is quite significant. But water plays a very, very important role in the Gospel of John, beginning, of course, with the Cana story of the changing of the water into wine, And then going on through the story of the Samaritan woman at the well, with the water, born of water and the water of eternal life, and then culminating in the story of Jesus' crucifixion, where only John mentions that when Jesus is stabbed in the side with the spear, blood and water come out. And so there's a thematic and symbolic connection between the beginning of the Gospel of John and the end of the Gospel of John. And the only other thing I'll throw out here, because there's so much more to say and there's no time for it, there are some really, really striking and intriguing parallels between the story of the wedding at Cana and the transformation of the water into wine, and the whole mythology of Dionysus and the Dionysus religion.
Absolutely.
So wine is the beverage of communion with the divine. So yes. I'll leave it at that. But Jesus is
good.
Sophia in John.
I see that you're all excellent exegetes here. And that's great. Water, of course, is the ultimate archetypal substance on this planet, there you go, making everything possible. But again, about Cana, and thank you for that resume. That's really valuable. I hope you will all remember that. It's the way that the stories get linked and the traditions get passed down and integrated like a rosary, because the archetypal meaning runs through the whole story all the way. An undisturbed thread, I think. That one person in the middle, and then we'll move on.
I just thought that because he turned his mother down, he had second thoughts about heeding her suggestion to be respectful.
Okay. Well, there's one, perhaps another thing to add about the wine before we move on. My sense is that the story focuses on something that's fundamental, basic, ordinary in life. The omnipresence of water in life, common, ordinary substance, of course, making life possible. But water is everywhere. Water's cheap, so to say. But to a desert people, water is something extra, special. But what about wine? Wine is extra special, too. And it connects us with Dionysus big time. In fact, Jesus and Dionysus look like companion figures. You know, a double satellite sort of thing. The meaning, something of the meaning that came to me out of this story was this. Jesus did not actively do anything, obviously of a molecular nature, to create ethyl alcohol in the water. He wasn't an organic chemist at this point. But what?
Like you.
Yeah, I can't do that. But the story is trying to tell us something about things that are common and things that are precious. Things that seem like they're ordinary elements of life. And for Thales, the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, the substance of the world, the creative substance of the world. But water is, so to say, common and ordinary. Wine is extraordinary in a certain sense. It requires that the juice of the fruit receive its spirit,